kids were in fourth grade and sixth grade when I started. Now they are a junior and a freshman in college.
I am a
freshman in college.
So you can deal with this.
Yeah. That's tough.
It was my last Mark son John would have.
But I mean, I obviously
4 years he would have been done for college.
Even I was at the office this weekend.
Well, I don't know when the graduation is, but he's going one more semester.
Yeah.
I mean, it worked out just great.
That's what they wanted to know.
All right, so we're going to start this meeting. Call this conference committee to order. This is the conference committee on Senate File 1270, the Transportation Omnibus Policy Bill. It is Wednesday, May 8th. It's about 2:37. A couple of quick announcements. Welcome, everyone. Glad to have you here. So we know the Senate and the House are both in session. So if there are votes in either body, we're going to suspend for a few minutes, have members run up and take their votes, and then please come back as quickly as you can. All right. We have a special conveyance for you. We have inside your packets is a side-by-side, there's a summary of the provisions that looks like this. And handouts, various handouts from different stakeholders and folks who have an opinion about various provisions in the conference committee reports. So with that, I think the best way, we're going to try to not extend this. I mean, we'd like to finish up today and have a conference committee report that we can sign soon and not meet again. Knock on wood. Hope that's possible. I think it is, though. What I think the best way to handle this is just simply walk through the side-by-side. The Senate has developed a proposal, an offer, and so we'll note which pieces the Senate would offer to the House as we move along our way. We'll just figure it out from there. Maybe we'll do one grand motion. What do you think, Council? Do one big motion on the Senate offer, move them as we go along? What is your opinion, your professional advice?
Mr. Chair, either one is okay. I think, maybe doing it piece by piece ultimately would be a little less complicated because there may be language, suggested language changes on various parts.
Right, and in a couple of thank you. We'll do that then. And then in a couple of instances, we do have to make some language changes. And in one instance, there's a fairly significant proposed change to the language. So I know that there are stakeholders here. This is on the scrap metal dealer stuff, and all the various stakeholders are here, or they're supposed to be, to tell us that there is an agreement and explain fully to us what exactly their proposal is before we accept this into the conference committee report, because those respective bills have not made it through their committee process. They're not on the floor of the Senate or the House, and so that'd be kind of a big deal for us to take into the conference committee report. We need to make sure we have a thorough hearing, and then our respective chairs are able to explain what's in the conference committee report when we bring it back to our chambers if we accept it into the report. So why don't we do some introductions very quickly, and then we'll get started. I'm Senator Scott Dibble, Chair of the Transportation Committee in the Senate. Folks can just go around the table. Start with.
I am Bonnie Berezovsky, Senate Counsel.
I'm Krista Boyd, Fiscal Analyst for Senate Transportation.
Michael Gordon, Committee Administrator for the Transportation and Public Safety Committee.
Senator Susan Kent, Vice Chair of the Transportation and Public Safety Committee.
Senator Jim Carlson from Eagan, and member of the Transportation Committee.
Senator Vicki Jensen, and I am a member of the Transportation Committee.
Don Peterson, a senator from St. Cloud and a GOP lead.
I'm Sandra Mason, and I represent 51A, which is Western Eagan and Northern Burnsville, and I'm on both the the House Transportation Policy and Finance Committees, and Vice Chair of the Policy Committee.
Rod Hamilton from District 22B, which would be Worthington-Windham, the southwestern part of the state.
Mary Swatsky, and I represent 17B, Candiota County.
I'm Frank Hornstein, and I am the chair of the Transportation Finance Committee in the House and a member of the Policy Committee, and I represent District 61A. Senator Dibble is my senator in Southwest and downtown Minneapolis.
Matt Scheer, Committee Administrator for the Transportation Committees in the House.
Andrew Lee, Fiscal Analyst for House Transportation.
Matt Burris with House Research.
I am the Chair of Transportation Policy.
Thank you. And staff over here. You can introduce yourselves. Great. So as we go along, if someone in the audience, welcome Commissioner Zelli. Commissioner Zelli is with us. So happy to have you here. So as we go along, everyone in the audience, if you'd like to hop to the table, and MnDOT, yourselves included, and share with us some thoughts about a particular provision. Wave your hands wildly, get my attention, and we'll take public testimony along the way. Commissioner Zelli, did you want to say anything at the outset here?
No, I'm
all right. Good. Very good. All right. Well, happy to have you here. Very good. Okay, with that, Ms. Berezovsky, do you want to start us off here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will go down the revisor side-by-side text document and indicate what is in the particular provision and whether it or not it is a part of the Senate offer. So the first provision is House Section 1, and Mr. Burris, do you want to explain what that is? And that is part of the Senate offer.
Mr. Chair and members, this is House-only language that would extend a sunset on authority for local units of government to perform snow removal in certain undeveloped subdivisions and areas where the developer is not able to otherwise do that snow removal. So it would push the expiration out by 1 year to 2014.
And members, please, we can go as fast or as slow as you like. Do not hesitate to ask questions of clarification or ask for folks to come to the table if we need to. So I think what we said we're going to do is make motions along the way. I'll entertain a motion on this provision. So anyone can move.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the House language from lines 1.26 to 2.18 or 2.19 then.
All right.
Be adopted. Representative Hamilton.
Both sides.
Right.
No,
okay.
Everybody
okay.
Wants.
Okay. All right. All right. I haven't chaired a conference committee like this ever, I don't think. I've just chaired conference committees that have like one item in it. It gets a little rusty. All right. All in favor of Representative Hamilton's motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, then we move over to the Senate side, and we have identical language in a number of these provisions. So the default side for purposes of my presentation and the Senate offer is the Senate language, even though it's identical. So Section 1 on R1 on the Senate side deals with logo signs by trunk highways or interstate highways, and this would add attractions as a category of business or other site that can be advertised through this sign franchise program on the highways. And related to that, then, is Section 2, and the text is on R2. And again, identical, but the Senate side, looking at the Senate side, this changes a number of the qualifications for listing on a logo sign, and the changes are numerous, and they have to do with how frequently the attraction is open, what type of facilities they have, whether they need to serve food, and so on. And Section 3, which begins on R3, is also related, and it just adds conforming language to refer to attractions, which are part of this logo sign program. Should I continue, or?
So those are the pieces from the MnDOT housekeeping. That extend, yeah. So why don't we just suspend there for a second, because then I think we get into another Senate file following. All right, so those provisions are all identical, and it is a part of the Senate offer to accept those pieces. I'll entertain a motion.
I'll move that, Senator.
All right. On the Hornstein motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Switch on.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senate Section 4 on the bottom of R3 relates to the Trunk Highway Emergency Relief Account, and it provides that money in the account may be used for transportation infrastructure, operation, and maintenance related to a disaster. Sections 5 and 6 are from the department bill, and these are part of the turnback provisions.
All right, those are identical. Senate offers those. Entertain a motion.
I so move.
All right, on the Sawatsky motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, then on page R4, section 8 on the House side, it's a technical difference. The language is really the same, and this has to do with the parking fees that are related to the I-394 ramps, and it allows use of fee revenues for all managed lanes, along with related multimodal and technology improvements for users of the parking facilities.
So in this instance, we need to move either the House or the Senate language, and I think the Senate have a preference in its offer?
We are preferring the House language.
Okay. Senate prefers to offer the House language. So I'll entertain a motion.
So move.
All right. On the Earhart motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Burris, did you want to say anything about House Section 9? It's not part of the Senate offer, and neither is Section 10.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Section 9 has actually already been enacted, so the committee could skip over that. Section 10 is a House-only position or provision that requires MnDOT in posting adjustments or addenda to contracts that have been put out for bid to limit those postings to have to be at least 24 hours in advance of when the bid process closes up for that contract. So it works like a time limiter to require posting in advance of adjustments to bids.
Right, and I recall when we took a look at this, and Representative Cornish has lobbied me on this. Apparently it's a problem that cropped up with the contractor that he knows, or at least that got his attention. I don't think we were opposed to this. We just wanted a little bit more information and get MnDOT's response and just find out more about it. So I see Mr. Werke from the Associated General Contractors and Mr. Peterson. So if you could help us understand this provision a little better.
Yeah.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members, Scott Peterson from the Department of Transportation. Yeah, we do have some concerns about this provision. It's in the fact that sometimes information comes to our attention, admittedly rather late in the process, and most of our bidding contractors are able to accommodate these late additions to contract provisions. The only other alternative to publishing these addenda late in the process is to postpone the letting to another date, which also has serious consequences associated with it as well. Contractors spend a lot of time and effort and money putting bids together, and then to have to delay them to another date sometimes causes them additional costs and inconvenience. And so we just, for those reasons, we have concerns about this particular provision.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Peterson?
I have a question.
Chair Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, isn't 24 hours a reasonable time for you not to be adding additional information on this?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, I don't know what's reasonable in terms of contractor's ability to respond. I'm sure if there are major provisions that are changed, 24 hours might be an unreasonably limited amount of time as well. I know that we try to exercise good judgment in what we do. Again, we're making that trade-off between, the last-minute addition of information that might do to prospective bidders and the other alternative, which is to delay the letting. And so I do think in talking to our construction folks that, the last-minute changes, if you will, that we send out are, the kind that can be reasonably accommodated by prospective bidders.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I believe Representative Cornish, like you said, did bring this forward, and he had some concerns where potentially the bid could be changed in the last minute and then somebody could lose the bid. I believe I have that correct. To the testifier, has there ever been an example of that?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hamilton, I don't know if there have been examples. I think there have been instances where bidders have failed to incorporate the new information into their bid. I don't know whether that meant that they lost the bid or not. I could provide that information to the committee if it would be of value, but right today I don't have that information.
Senator Carlson, then Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Peterson, is this considered a scope change or an adder? And in how do you differentiate between those that are supposed to be accommodated in the original bid and those that would have a scope change or an addition onto the bid? And again, I guess I would like to note also, is a change like this, is it possible for a bidder to lose the bid because of a scope change like this?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, again, I'm not aware specifically of the magnitude of some of these changes, although it is my understanding that these are changes that are, in the judgment of the people at the department, are changes that contractors would be able to process and incorporate into their bids in time to make the letting deadline. Something that would be a significant scope change to a project would not fit that definition, in my view. And, and our interest is in getting good cost-competitive bids. And for significant changes in contract requirements, we recognize that would not be possible for contractors to provide that in a relatively short period of time, certainly within 24 hours.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I guess my question revolves around, you're talking about a delay in the bidding process. It would be for 24 hours, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jensen, no, that the delay would probably be at least 2 weeks, maybe a month. We have regularly scheduled lettings, but we wouldn't just delay the entire letting for a change in one proposed contract letting. We have most contract lettings, we have more than one contract, and they're regularly scheduled, and so we would just delay it till the next one, I believe.
Anything further for Mr. Peterson? Welcome, Mr. Warkey.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Tim Warkey. I represent the Associated General Contractors. I'm going to concur with what Mr. Peterson relayed to the committee and tell you that we are opposed to this provision. Because of the fact, the facts that Mr. Peterson laid out, that the thing that we do not like to see is to have one of two things happen: either the letting be delayed, or that the letting commence and that the error or mistake be discovered post letting, and that the contractor of record, the apparent low bidder, have all bids be canceled by the department because of some error. Could be a quantities error, could be a calculation error, or something that caused the bid to become unbalanced or irregular, and then MnDOT has to pull that award from that apparent low bidder. It's not a good process. No one likes to see addendums. But it is a necessary process. When you put a letting together, often with 6, 8, 10, or 12 different projects, it's not inconceivable that there could be a mistake made in, like I said, quantities or some sort of calculation. And then as contractors take those proposals and pull them apart and bid the work, they oftentimes will discover that error. And then it's incumbent upon the contractor who discovers that to notify the department that they think this section is in error, and then an addendum should be issued so that the bid is not irregular, in that opportunity then of having the bid retracted after the letting has occurred, which benefits no one. And we think that addendums, although not perfect, are a necessary part of the process.
Thank you. I have Senator Jensen, then Representative
Chairman. Sure. Thank you for the information. I'm wondering, so you've got a deadline.
Okay. Excuse me. We need to pause and recess for just a moment. Senators need to go up and vote. Just we'll be right back. We have a quorum on both sides, so we can proceed.
Well, that was quick.
All right. So, Senator Jensen, we interrupted you. You had a question for Mr. Werke.
Yes, I did. How far in advance are the bid lettings scheduled, the original ones, without an addendum?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Werke.
Senator Jensen, the department puts out a schedule of proposed letting, and that's one indicator to let contractors know which projects are upcoming, but then they're also required by law and statute to advertise for those projects, and I believe it's a 21-day advertisement, which makes the plans and everything available. And so you have 21 days is the sort of the normal time frame where a contractor has the ability to look at those plans and then start preparing their bid.
Senator Jensen.
Mr. Chair, so if everyone understood the way that this proposal is, including the contractors, that the deadline to have those addendums done would just be a day before. And they would have then that to, they would understand that 24-hour period, there wouldn't be any addendums. So if everybody knew the deadline is just 24 hours in advance of the letting and understood it that way, all you're really giving is a 24-hour period for those people that want to do the bid, the opportunity to understand there wouldn't be any changes. Am I understanding that correctly?
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Jensen, yes, that would be the case. Mr. Peterson and I were visiting during the recess here in basically both agreeing that no one likes to see addendums. However, we did talk about instances where there are, unfortunately, there could be a minor change. There could be, a small quantities error or something like that that would not serve anyone because of an artificial deadline that in this day and age of being able to notify people almost immediately to make a small entry change in their bid, that it wouldn't be that big of a situation where you'd want to cancel a significant contract award because of that.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Chair. One final question, then. What happens if you find that error the day after the letting?
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jensen, it may be more appropriate for MnDOT to answer, but in my experience, what happens if it is a material error with regard to the project that should have been discovered, that the department has at its discretion to not award and to cancel all bids. And that's the most unfortunate situation where you spend, as a contractor, you spend time, effort and resources putting a bid together and then have an apparent low bidder read on bid day, and then I think the department has 30 days in which to award, and I've seen it happen on the 29th day where the decision was made to cancel all bids and start over. So,
Mr. Peterson, do you have any, did Mr. Werke get it right?
Mr. Chairman, yeah, he's at least as well informed on this as I am.
I recall, yeah, you used to be on your side of the table. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Peterson, how do you handle this currently? Say somebody somebody had already submitted a bid, then you made the put in the addendum. Are they would somebody from your office or MnDOT specifically go back to tell these people about the change in the event that they didn't know, or if somebody was submitting it again, maybe they didn't know? How is it handled right now?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mason, my understanding is that we have basically a list of potential bidders, an email list, and so we would send out a blast email to all potential bidders announcing the change with the associated, you know, bid number, so that anybody who has an interest in bidding on that project would become aware of it within, you know, a matter of seconds if they're checking their email regularly.
Thank you.
Senator Carlson.
I guess I thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to hear from Mr. Werke that, you know, and we realize that there's always the errors and omissions and good faith errors and omissions. And I guess what I'd like to hear from you is you're comfortable with the process the way it is, and the ability to appeal a bid, and the ability to speak to the to MnDOT or to the bidding party to be able to clear up any problems without without a problem, or to if it's a huge problem, request an adder, or to rescind the bid. And you're comfortable with the way it is.
Mr. Werke.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, yes and no. I think, you know, no one, it's an imperfect process. Errors occur regularly, and it's just a matter of the way things develop. And there needs to be a process in place that's fair to everyone, that allows for attention to those errors. I think the processes that MnDOT has put forward prior to bid letting or bid opening are as fair as they can probably be. There is an obligation on those that are bidding to, as Mr. Peterson pointed out, to pay attention and to check regularly to see if there has been addendas issued and to make the adjustments in your bid. There are likely cases out there where someone missed an addendum and bid it as they saw it, is a common term, bid the project as you see it, and had to absorb a cost overrun or an additional cost in their proposal because they didn't see it. So it's imperfect process, but it seems to work well. And our position, again, to reiterate, is that we feel if there's an artificial deadline imposed on it, it's not going to clean up the process. It's just going to maybe more encumbrance on it and its implementation.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I spoke to Representative Cornish, or was contacted by Representative Cornish, and I'll try to take what he said and run it through my filter.
All right.
And basically, there are individuals, whether they're contractors.
May I interrupt? And yes. My apologies. We need to recess for a moment for a vote. Thank you.
Fair enough.
All right. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And like I was saying, I visited with Representative Cornish, and I'm trying to run it through my filter. He said some of the contractors and subcontractors, some of them do have concerns, like were pointed out. Some of them are afraid to complain for fear of retribution. And so he said he wanted us to make this point and get it across. If you haven't already, if you'd circle back around, my request to you is circle back around, visit with Representative Cornish as well on what his concerns are. And then, Mr. Chairman, I'll make the motion to, I guess, skip Section 10 and move on to the next.
Right. I guess that doesn't require a motion. We're just going to move on.
Let's move on.
All right. Great. Thank you. All right. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, continuing then on page R5 of the side-by-side, on the Senate side is Section 8. And that is a provision that encourages MnDOT to conduct a periodic examination of real estate that's owned by the department that is no longer needed for trunk highway purposes to determine whether the property might be disposed of. And it has a reporting requirement.
So, members, this is this was a Senate file offered by Senator Senjum. This is significantly modified from its original form, so that it's it has the encouraging language, and so it did not trigger a fiscal note. I don't remember the details of what exactly the problem was that's being solved. But, you know, it seems to make some sense to take a look at a property that's no longer needed that MnDOT owns and see if it makes sense to, you know, divest themselves of it. Now, I'm sorry, Senator Peterson, did you have a...
Chair, I think the other issue that Senator Senjum raised and that I recall is that, you know, this is simply an effort, I think, to get property that's not being used, that's in a non-taxable situation, and at least make it available if somebody does want it and get it back in the property tax rolls. It clearly moves the state in the right direction and the local municipalities that potentially could charge property tax.
All right. So this is in the Senate offer for the information of the committee. Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I actually have an amendment. I don't know when it would be appropriate to introduce that, but...
Right now would be the time. Okay. Is this the go ahead.
Yeah. Well, Representative Bernardi, who's the vice chair of our committee in the House, wanted me to present this. She had some concerns that some of this property that would be under study or possible disposition by MnDOT may be suitable for bike and pedestrian uses, and just wanted to make sure that this language was inserted. You know, a lot of these are some right-of-ways that are adjacent to roads, and it may be potentially appropriate for these kinds of uses. I don't know whether MnDOT has a perspective on this, but I would like to move the A20, Mr. Chairman.
All right. The A20 is before us. Mr. Rudin.
Thank you. I'm Eric Rudin, MnDOT Government Affairs. Mr. Chair, we have no issues with the amendment offered by Representative Hornstein. If I could take the opportunity, though, to just discuss the original Senate language, there's a definition of surplus property in there, and apparently there was a court case that the department was involved with a couple of years ago, and it has come to our attention that it might create some problems for the department to refer to this property as surplus. I think that could be dealt with by on line 5.5, deleting declared as surplus, and instead inserting no longer needed, and then also deleting paragraph C on lines 5.11 through 5.13.
Okay. Representative Hornstein, are you willing to incorporate those changes into your amendment?
I would, Mr. Chairman.
All right. However, I think Senate counsel indicated that there was an amendment, another amendment that MnDOT helped to develop.
Mr. Chair, there was language in the House finance bill, which MnDOT worked with the authors on the House side, that also addressed this issue. There was another difference in the House version in that the House report was only required for two cycles, whereas the Senate report would be ongoing. The House also added language allowing proceeds from the sale of the property to be used to cover the expenses, which is not a MnDOT request, but that was something that was discussed on the House side to try to facilitate this process.
All right. Well, I'm talking about something that's not in front of all of you here. I see it right here. But what I'd rather do, members, if it's all right, is... I know that this language that Senator Senjum developed, developed in consultation and conversation with MnDOT. MnDOT was at least neutral at the point at which we adopted it into our bill. This language, I understand, Mr. Rudin, actually triggers a fiscal note, even though it's internal to the fund. It still triggers a fiscal note, which presents some problems for our policy bill, which we don't want to pick up fiscal notes on, or else we got trouble. I got trouble, at least, with my finance chair. So, you know, if we need to go back and take a look at some of this maybe next year, would that be acceptable?
Mr. Chair, I think that would be acceptable.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Anything further on the Hornstein amendment?
Mr. Chairman, does that mean that his propositions were leaving out of here now? No longer needed, and 511 to 513? Are we in 14 or not?
Well, what we would do, Chair Earhart, if I understand your question, is first we would act on the the Hornstein motion with the Bernardi language, with these suggestions that Mr. Rudin made, which is replacing the words on 5.5 declared as surplus with the words no longer needed, and striking lines 5.11 to 5.13, and then we wouldn't pick up this language, which is gets us bogged down in fiscal issues. Okay. All right. So first thing we would need to do is vote on the amendment. So anything further on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed no. Motion carries. And then we need a motion to accept Section 8 of the Senate side.
So moved.
All right. On the Earhart motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed no. Motion carries. As amended, I don't know if I said that. All right. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, on R5, Sections 9 and 10, goes into R6 as well, those eliminate requirements that the commissioner publish notice of a request when a political subdivision wants to apply for a variance from engineering standards concerning engineering standards for natural preservation routes and money needs for county state aid highways and municipal state aid streets. And I'll lump Section 11 in with that one, too. And Section 11 just removes an obsolete reference to calculating money needs for a road that's both county state aid highway and a municipal state aid street.
And you said, all right, this is part of the MnDOT housekeeping bill.
That is part of the MnDOT housekeeping bill, and those are identical provisions in both, right, on both sides.
All right. Part of the Senate offer. Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I so move.
All right. On the Kent motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed no. Motion carries. All right. Now we're getting to the Department of Public Safety housekeeping bill. Again, carried by Senator. By the way, almost everything you see, Senator Kent. So, Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, on R6, towards the bottom, we start with Section 12, and that deletes a requirement that the Registrar of Motor Vehicles distribute vehicle registrations uniformly throughout the calendar year. Instead, it adds language that specifies that vehicles that are registered under the monthly series system should be registered for a minimum of 12 consecutive months. Section 13 modifies some exceptions to the monthly series motor vehicle registration system, except as necessary to equalize registration workload for the department. Section 14, the text of which is on R8, clarifies that a driveway in transit license plate that's issued to a tow operator is not a valid permanent vehicle registration, and it's not valid outside Minnesota. Shall I continue?
Yep.
Section 15 has to do with veteran special license plates, and it eliminates certain design specifications, and it also eliminates special plates for veterans of World War I.
So we're going to have you go through to where there's a break in the DPS housekeeping.
Okay. Mr. Chair, then Section 16 modifies the provisions relating to payment of registration taxes on a prorated basis by non-residents of the state. Section 17, which is the text is on R11, defines on an occasional basis regarding the issuance of trip permits. And the new definition allows no more than one trip permit per vehicle within a 30-day period. Section 18, Section 18 allows a licensed used motor vehicle parts dealer to sell, solicit, or advertise used parts and scrap metals, but it prohibits the selling of new or used motor vehicles at retail or to a dealer by a used vehicle parts dealer.
This is not the scrap issue that we're going to get into in a few minutes.
Then we move to the House side, and these provisions are nearly identical, but House Section 21 is recommended by the Senate for adoption because there is a typo on the Senate side. And the provision modifies requirements for a dealer's, when a dealer purchases an older model vehicle for the purpose of dismantling or destroying it, there are certain reporting requirements that have to be followed, and there are record-keeping requirements as well. And it has to do as well with record retention requirements for that type of transaction. So that takes us all the way down to the bottom of R13 and top. The text for the next section on the Senate side then is on R14, and that is Section 20, and that deletes the requirement that an application for a motor vehicle dealer license be denied if the applicant was denied a license within the previous year.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's okay, could I move Sections 12 through Sections 18 of the Senate language just so that I can keep up on where we're at on agreement language here as well. So I would move Sections 12 through 18 of the Senate language, and then, Mr. Chairman, Section 21 of the House language, and Section 20 again of the Senate language to get us caught up to current.
All right. On the Hamilton motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, then, I believe we haven't picked up Section 21.
We have not.
Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And then Section 22 is somewhat related to 21, and that has to do with a dealer's purchase of a late model or high-value vehicle to dismantle or destroy. And the previous section and this section both require the dealer to obtain the certificate of title or verify ownership. Mm-hmm. To notify secured parties and then to retain the title or the motor vehicle record. And it has to do with period of notification to the department as well.
So this was in the housekeeping bill, but not picked up by the House. And it was in the Senate offer. Any questions on Sections 21 and 22?
Mr. Chairman, I think they're waiting for an amendment to come out to press. Is that
on the issue that we're okay? So do we need to suspend on this until? Okay, we'll hold off on this. We'll jump over these pieces and come back until an amendment comes off the presses. All right, very good. Section 23.
Should we pick up the scrap? This is the scrap provision then.
Oh, okay. So should we hold off on that, too, or are we ready to dive into that issue?
Hold off on this.
Okay. So these three sections all need to be kind of dealt with together?
In the next. All right. And 24 as well.
And 24. Okay, we'll jump over those. Tow truck permit, Section 25. Oh, this was an amendment that I offered on the committee? This is just a technical change, right? What is it?
Mr. Chair, Section 25 on the Senate side, it's on R16. It just corrects a cross-reference because this particular language had been moved into 168B out of 169, and it relates to tow truck permits. So rather than say the weight limitations of this chapter, it has to say 169 where the weight limitations are located.
Okay. All right. It's in the Senate offer. I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kent.
I so move.
All right. All in favor of the Kent motion to accept Section 25 on the Senate side. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Moving on to school buses, Type 3 school buses.
Mr. Chair, Section 26 deals with the definition of school bus and the definition of a Type 3 vehicle. And that language is located on 17.32 on on page R17, and that simply substitutes vehicles for cars, station wagons, and vans.
All right. They're identical?
Yes.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
It's in the Senate offer. I'll entertain a motion.
I will move that.
On Representative Mason's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Section 24 on the House side.
Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Burris could discuss that one.
Mr. Chair and members, this House-only provision on page R17 would eliminate some language that restricts local units of government from prohibiting flashing red lights. So the effect would be that local units of government could prohibit flashing red lights in funeral escorts and other processions and other escorted vehicle situations.
And I recall that this was an, I don't know if it was an agency initiative, but supported by the agency. It was a Senator Carlson bill.
Yes.
It did not prevail on the Senate side. It was defeated in the Senate committee. So it's not in the Senate offer, but we can have a discussion. Motions are in order. discussion, or we can entertain a motion or move on.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was contacted by some folks in the area in which I represent, and they asked me to speak out against this language.
Right.
They're not in support of this, whether it's they're assisting with funerals or whatever the case may be. So I would speak against the House language on this provision.
Can you put him on here? All right, Representative Carlson, or Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I would speak for this language. This was a problem where there's increasing frequency of using red lights that are flashing and that show to the forward. Red lights showing behind is not a problem, and red lights showing when a vehicle, a escort vehicle, is stopped is not a problem also. And what the department wanted to do was to make sure that only licensed police officers are using vehicles that have flashing red lights.
All right. That's a speech in favor. Anything further?
Mr. Chairman, I have someone I think wanted to, if I can find the right section, that said someone here
all right,
uses
one.
Red lights. And
Dwight Patterson?
Yes.
All right. So is Dwight Patterson from Avon here? Would you like to testify?
Yes, sir.
All right. Please come to the table. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Dwight Patterson. I am a co-owner of Pat's LLC. We are a licensed through the Department of Public Safety as a private security company, also known as a licensed protective agent. We do quite a few funerals here in the Twin Cities and out in our area, St. Cloud, Park Rapids area up north. We provide, like I say, oversized loads also. But the thing of it is the red lights, when you're escorting a family of maybe 30 people in 25 cars, it's important to try to keep all them vehicles together so they can get to the cemetery. And we try to do it safely. And the way we do that is by displaying a red light to the front so that oncoming traffic or people at intersections know that this is some type of procession. And, you know, we want to do it safely. And if we remove the language of the red lights to the front, then we're not providing them safety transportation or safety, you know, to procession. So when it came to the Senate, the State Patrol was there, and we also had a couple of other licensed protective agencies there and testified on their behalf, and it was defeated in the Senate committee 11-1. And I hope that the House committee members will look at that as that this is something that our businesses rely upon, and take the language out of the bill completely. So let us continue working and providing the safety that the citizens of Minnesota need.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. Questions for Mr. Patterson, Senator. Yeah, I'm having a heck of a time here. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Patterson, could you describe in a little bit more detail the type of light you use and how that might differ from law enforcement or public safety in terms of ambulance or fire and what the differences are?
Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Chair. Senator Patterson, thank you. We use a lot of the licensed protective agents. They use a light bar on top of their vehicle, and this light bar will usually have amber and reds both flashing at the same time. We do what's called light management. If there's no need for the red lights to be on, we have a switch. We can turn just the reds off. When we come to an intersection that we need to control so we don't have cross traffic, then we'll turn our red lights on. I hope that answers your question there, Senator, Chair.
Thank you. I saw some other hands, but I lost track.
Mason.
Oh, Representative Mason, did you have a
question? Oh, Mr. Chair, Mr. Patterson, and I did receive your letter. I understand the need to use the lights on your vehicles, but what would be the difference if you used a different color? I mean, if we reserve the red for State Patrol, et cetera, and police, what would stop you from using a different color, but it would still attract the attention that I think you're looking for?
Mr. Patterson.
Chair, Representative, that would be possible, but then we'd have to go in and also get some type of legislation to, for example, let's say we were to use blue lights like the Minnesota Transportation Department of Transportation Safety First pickups. They're yellow. They have a blue and ambers. If we were to use something of that color, blue and amber, then I think we would have to go back and submit legislation so that the motoring public would be aware that when they see the blue and amber that they would need to pull over and yield to the right-of-way, the same as an authorized emergency vehicle.
Thank you.
Right. Senator Carlson, then Senator Kent.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that was exactly the issue here, is that red lights facing forward are the universal signal for you to pull over and stop. And the agency said that they routinely see amber lights as escorts, because that's what generally is the color that's used for escorting wide loads and heavy loads, other things like that. So the red lights facing forward encroach on that universal description of an emergency vehicle or a police officer that wants you to get out of the way.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My recollection and concerns on this issue was that when the professionals involved in these issues talk about the specific purposes of all these specific different colors, and by the time you get through red and amber and blue and white, there's an assumption that each of these actually has a meaning to all of the drivers out on the roads, and that there's some sort of clarity. And when you see some flashing light, you go through some process where you sort that all out and make a decision based on it. And my understanding and sense of this is that that's just not the case. There's just a lot of confusion. People see flashing lights, and they respond appropriately. And when I asked the agency, because historically the funeral processions, for example, had been done by law enforcement, but now that's been outsourced. But I guess in some cases, ostensibly, law enforcement could still provide that service. They might use the red lights in those cases, but these officers for the exact same purpose are not supposed to under this. And so, again, it's just reinforcing the confusion. And so if there's not clarity about the purpose, why are we insisting on it? Sorry, I know that was probably just as confusing as what I'm talking about, but thank you for indulging.
All right. Anything further for Mr. Patterson? Would the Department of Public Safety like to come forward and shed their perspective on this discussion? Thank you. Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon. My name is Nancy Silky. I'm a major with the Minnesota State Patrol. Mr. Chair, members of the committee,
The portion of the bill that we are looking at here is an agency initiative of the State Patrol and the Department of Public Safety and supported by the Governor's Office. Really, the intent of the bill is to address an important provision for public safety and emergency response, which is the use of the red lights. The purpose of the bill and the reason that we did bring it forward to the legislature was so that we could address the conflicting language and to provide clarity regarding the intent of the flashing red lights. There are several statutes that already exist that I won't go into that, you know, we spoke to in committee regarding prohibited lights, emergency vehicles, and right-of-way authority for use, and the Department of Public Safety's, the commissioner's ability to authorize permits through other specific requirements. But by the very nature of emergency vehicle response, it's important for us that emergency vehicles must have obedience and compliance with respect to the red lights, and that when they're displayed by emergency vehicles, that people take the immediate action. So we felt that this bill provided clarity on the authority to use red lights. Restricting red lights only to emergency vehicles is stated in several other statutes. The statute referenced in this bill is somewhat inconsistent with the limitations defined in other areas that we spoke about when we provided documentation in the policy portion. So I won't get into that, but in summary, the changes of the bill would create consistency and would require that amber lighting would be used in those situations for non-emergency vehicles, which would be escorting funeral processions, oversized buildings, and heavy equipment. And the vehicles do not fit the statutory definitions in other areas of statute, and so they wouldn't have the authority to have the red flashing lights. Rather, they would be operating with the amber or yellow lights. It's our position that the use of amber lighting and manual traffic control that is authorized for licensed protective agents is sufficient to ensure their safety for non-emergency vehicle operation in that capacity. The chiefs of police, ambulance operators, fire departments, and others universally support limiting the red light usage to emergency vehicles. And so the Department of Public Safety has consistently opposed the use of red lights to anything other than emergency vehicles, so that we do have that understanding from all of the motoring public that when you do see red lights, that it's an emergency that requires their immediate attention and action. And so that was the intent. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it Major Selke?
Yes.
Any questions for Major Selke? No. All right. Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Chair. I understand the State Patrol agency's issue and standing. However, we are licensed out of the state of Minnesota. We go through the training, and I hope that, you know, everybody is understanding that when the State Patrol does these funerals, they're also using red lights. When they're escorting these oversized loads that are 22 feet wide, they're also using red lights. Are they confusing the public also? I just want to be on the same level playing field. I want to give the trucking companies, the funeral homes, the flexibility and the choice of whether they want to use a licensed peace officer or a licensed protective agent. It all comes down to safety, you know. I don't think it comes down to confusion. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Patterson. Anything further, members? All right. Does anyone have a motion? Senator Carlson? Sorry. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I move House Section 24 be recommended.
All right. Senator Carlson moves Section 24 on the House side. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
No.
No. Motion fails. All right. Moving on, are we ready to jump back to? Okay, we'll just keep rolling. We do need to move along a little bit more quickly, members. So we have sections 27 and 25.
Mr. Chair, these sections are identical, but they are not part of the Senate offer. And the effect of this section is to increase from 55 to 60 miles per hour the general speed limit on roads that don't have a different specified statutory speed limit.
Members, we have four letters
in our packets. The Association of Minnesota Counties, Minnesota County Engineers, is that true? Oh, yeah, Minnesota County Engineers, Minnesota Association of Townships, and the Department of Transportation, all expressing opposition to this provision. You can read those at your leisure. Any questions? Any motions?
Senator Peterson. Chair, I would speak in favor of this. You may recall this issue was an effort and a bill from Senator Westrom from West Central Minnesota, and deals with this issue and the roadways there. And again, it passed out of the Senate, and I would urge your support in including this in the bill. I think it was the belief of the committee at that time. I don't recall the vote, but I'm not sure it was particularly close, but I think it's an effort that certainly deserves some merit and a chance to give folks in some rural areas a chance just to go a little bit faster and get where they need to be. So.
All right. Thank you. Anything further, members? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'd echo that. We have a position in this, both the House and the Senate, in favor of it, so I would support it as well.
Great. All right. On the anything further, members? On the Peterson, did anyone want to testify?
You know,
I hesitate.
You
don't have to testify. You can, absolutely.
I have some handouts.
We'll have someone bring those to you. Thank you.
We're going to vote it
pass. Some amendment.
Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Sue Groth, and I'm a state traffic engineer. And I'm here to testify in opposition to raising statutory speed limits on all other roads from 55 to 60 miles per hour. The purpose first of all, thank you for letting me testify today. The purpose for statutory speed limits is to provide uniform and maximum value without any signing. The majority of our county roads and our township roads are governed by statutory speed limits. I think that's a very important point for everybody to understand. We estimate that this bill will affect 40,000 miles of county roads and 60,000 miles of township roads. So a total of over 100,000 miles of roads will be affected by this change. We do not support this because we believe the results, it would result in an overall increase in travel speeds on these roads and an increase in the total number of crashes, serious injuries, and fatalities. And research since the late 1980s has shown that when we've raised speed limits, crashes and severity rates do go up. I'd like you all to refer to the graph that I handed out. I have a couple handouts for you to look at. I hope that all of you have heard of Minnesota's Towards Zero Death program. We are all very proud of the progress that we've been making towards reducing fatalities and serious injuries in the state of Minnesota. And this is a partnership between MnDOT, the Department of Public Safety, State Patrol, Health, local roads, and many other safety partners. I think that this graph shows that we've made great progress. Last year, unfortunately, we did see an uptake in our fatalities, and this year we're running slightly ahead of where we were last year, so that does raise some concerns for me. And I think we need to continue to make policy choices that keep us moving in the direction of reducing fatal and serious injury crashes, and I think that this bill is going in the wrong direction. I'd like you to refer next to this little card that is your transportation trivia facts, a great card to have with you. If you could turn to the table on that card that starts at the top, says 2011 roadway crash facts. If you look on this card, it lists the numbers of miles of county roads and township roads and different types of roads. You can see that our county roads and our township roads are the roads that are going to be the majority of roads affected by this change. Again, 100,000 miles of them. Those are our least safe roadways that we have in our state. And so, again, we think that this will directly impact those least safe roads. I wanted to also just take a time. I think a picture tells a thousand words. I've provided you with three pictures of different roadway types so that you can get a sense for what we're looking at and how these this change will affect different roadways. The very first page is a page of just, we took some pictures from our video log, and this shows what a county road, a typical county road, would look like. You can see from these pictures that county roads typically will have rolling hills, narrow shoulders, deep ditches, driveway accesses, and less space in the clear zone. So these are the roads that I'm most concerned about. The middle page, or page two, is the 7,500 miles of state roads that would be affected by this. And you can see these roadways, some of them do also have narrower shoulders, curves, deep ditches, and are a concern for people that are driving 60 miles per hour. The very last page is a page that shows a picture of a couple roadways where in 2006 MnDOT did, through the ability that we currently have through our through statute, the commissioner raised speed limits on these two sets of roads. 791 miles. You can see the difference on those roads where you've got a nice wide shoulder, great recovery space, rumble strips in some cases, and a larger clear zone. So again, we felt that these roads, in addition to having the geometrics that we think could support a 60 mile per hour, they also have had a lower fatality rate and crash rate than other roadways with similar characteristics. So those are the ones that we chose to raise in 2006. So I just think, in conclusion, I'm concerned about this legislation. Again, I think it's a policy change that's going to take us in the wrong direction.
Thank you, Ms. Groth. Questions, members? All right, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And ma'am, would that what's the speed limit on a road? If this would be adopted, a road that has a sign saying 55, but we've adopted a law that says that it could be 60, what speed limit would it be?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Groh.
And Senator, right now the way that it works is if there, typically, I'll just say typically, if there's a sign installed, the road would remain at that speed limit until the sign was changed. And that's the way this law is currently written. It's written that as signs would be changed, the speed limits would be changed. But unfortunately, on county and township roads, many or most of them are not posted. So this law, although it's a little ambiguous because we're not sure whether it's requiring people, townships, and counties to now install signs where they didn't have signs by the way it's being implemented, it could be interpreted that immediately those 100,000 miles that are not signed would be 60 miles per hour, whereas the roads that are signed, which are all of MnDOT roads, are signed. Those would not change automatically until the signs would be changed.
Thank you.
Right. Any further questions for Ms. Groth? All right.
Thank you.
Please introduce yourself.
Yes. I am Christy Sebastian. I am representing the Minnesota County Engineer Association. I am a transportation county engineer with the safety committee for MCA. The majority of the county roadways, 45,000 miles, are statutory 55 miles an hour. The state roadways, as Ms. Grove just said, are typically done through the state statute, through a commission order. So therefore, the speed limit has the most direct effect on the county roadways and townships. Our concern is both of safety and financial impacts. From a safety perspective, and the pictures you have was a great representation, we have many two-lane, narrow shoulder or no-shoulder roadways, gravel roadways, and then some roadways that accommodate very high volumes of traffic, maybe a four-lane divided section. So based on these different characteristics, many of those cannot be navigated safely at 60 miles an hour. that's from the safety perspective. Then from the financial side, we would need to look at all of those roadways and reassess all of our curves and passing zones to change those in order to accommodate this higher speed or mark what isn't safe. There is already a mechanism pursuant to State Statute 169.14, which allows the Commissioner of Transportation to opt to post the appropriate speed, which, including on county roadways, could be a 60 mile per hour if that was warranted. So the Minnesota County Engineer Association recommends leaving the statutory speed limit at 55 miles an hour to allow county engineers to work with the Minnesota Department of Transportation to determine the safe and appropriate speedways of the roadways in our communities.
All right, thank you, Ms. Sebastian. Any questions for Ms. Sebastian? All right, great. Ms. Bryduck.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Abby Bryduck. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties, and we have some of the same concerns that you've already heard expressed, but specifically the effective date language does leave a question as to whether many of our unposted roads may now need to be posted to in order to reflect the speed limit change. We think this may create some liability issues because of the lack of clarity. And if we do determine that we're going to need to post this roads, this will be a substantial cost to the counties and townships as well, Mr. Shulam will mention. And, you know, part of this concern is that I don't think necessarily this problem is insurmountable, but the fact that this proposal didn't have a proper hearing, we didn't get to the opportunity to weigh in on these possible effects and changes. And so we'd like to take a step back and recommend or request that the conference committee report does not adopt this provision.
Any questions for Ms. Bradett? Mr. Sewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Ken Sewell. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Townships. You already have my letter, and you've heard much of the testimony already that we would share. I think it's very clear to understand that the vast majority of town roads were never engineered. Many of them are the 100-and-some-year-old pathways that have evolved into roads over time and that we're responsible for. We get numerous requests throughout the year of how do we lower speed limits, and we have to refer them to MnDOT for the speed study and the report that MnDOT must do before you can lower a speed limit. If you now increase the default, I think you're going to increase the burden on MnDOT with the number of speed studies to lower it back to 55 or perhaps even lower. The roads simply are not safe for 60 miles an hour in the vast majority of cases. The expense, I don't think there's any ambiguity in the effective date. It says this section is effective upon the placement of conforming signs. And it goes on to say by the local authorities for the roads under our control. The placement must occur during the replacement of signs, but not later than January of 2025. So if there are no signs, in order for this to take effect, signs have to be put up, which is a new mandate. We must erect signs, or this section of law can never take effect. I don't think there's any court that would say you're passing a law that could never take effect. That would be an absurd result. So this creates an absolute mandate on us to put signs up on 56,000 miles of road, many of which are 60,000, depending on which figures you're looking at, because it fluctuates, that most of which have no signs already, which would be a massive expense. Many of you heard us talking about the sign retroreflectivity program and the millions of dollars that was going to cost. We prevailed at the federal level on that. This would be bringing back a similar mandate. So we would also encourage, do not include this in the conference report. If somebody would like to bring it back next year for full debate, we're welcome to have the discussion, but it's not ready to be included in the conference committee report.
Thank you, Mr. Sill. Members, anything?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean,
Senator Peterson.
In terms of the whole idea of the costs associated with the additional signs, that's not the author's intent. That would not be the legislative intent. And in my short time here, just since 2010, I've been involved in one of these situations where a bill that I was the author of passed, and the Department of Labor interpreted it differently, members. And quite frankly, it was a couple phone calls and a letter from my Senate office explaining and what the legislative intent was. Fortunately, the commissioner of the Department of Labor agreed and withdrew the enforcement action that his staff was going down that path, members. And I think it's as simple as that. The author of this bill and the legislative intent is not to put up a bunch of new signs. that's not accurate, and that's not what the author's intent is. So I would encourage your support of this as we move forward. If it's interpreted differently, I'm certain the author will get that fixed, and I'm sure he will express his legislative intent through that process. So.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just using the information that was handed out and to address the concerns and push maybe a little bit of pushback here, going off the pictures of the state highways that were posted at 60 mile an hour and then the county and the township roads, if you add it up on the fun facts here, or excuse me, the facts, crash facts, sorry, there's about 10,000 of the trunk highway miles with about 20,000 crashes, and there's 107,000 miles with about 20,000 crashes of the other. So I understand the concern, but again, here we're able to operate safely on the number of roads that we have for counties and townships as well.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you. All right, members. Chair Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, Senator Peterson has made a motion to adopt the House language in this case. Am I correct?
I think so, yeah. Well, nope. I do remember a Peterson motion.
Nope, I'm in support of the Senate language that would raise the mileage to 60 miles an hour. That was the intent of my motion, to support the Senate language.
I think they're identical, aren't they?
Identical.
Yeah.
It says identical.
Yep, okay.
All right. Well, Mr. Chairman, in view of the Senate author of this language originally, does not drive, as far as I'm concerned, does not have the capability of looking at things like we are looking at them and we may look at them, I'm going to suggest that the House vote no on this Senator Peterson's amendment.
Well, Senator Peterson. Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, it is a fact that Senator Westrom is blind. There's no question about that. But clearly, he's representing his constituents West Central Minnesota. And I can assure you, Senator Westrom would not have continued to work on this issue as he has repeatedly, session after session after session, if it were not a desire of his constituents and it's an effort to represent him. So
I don't support this provision myself, but I will attest to Senator Westrom's fidelity to this issue, and he's worked on it, and he cares about it, and he does travel around the state. You know, he wants to travel around faster. So I think he is, fully... he's got full standing in pursuing this issue. Nevertheless, I just disagree with him. All right. Anything further, members? All right. On the Peterson motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
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 Motion fails.
Division.
All right. We have a division. Senator Carlson, if you could go to your seat. We have a division. All in favor of the Peterson motion, raise your hand. All opposed, raise your hand. All right. Well, those in favor have really loud voices, but I think I heard right. Okay. Motion fails. Catch the calendar. You got it. All right, it's very good. All right, okay, so we're moving on to our fun bicycle provisions. Had a lot of discussion about, so, and at least in these first few, the provisions are identical, so we don't really have to necessarily have testimony unless we really want to discuss this even more. Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, beginning on page R19, and these are identical provisions, Senate Section 28 and House Section 26, it begins. That section prohibits a driver from passing another vehicle on the right by moving into a bicycle lane. Section 29 on the following page allows a driver to drive in a bicycle lane to perform parking maneuvers. And the third section, Section 30, again identical, It describes legal.
Paragraph G is a little different.
Oh, yes. Sorry about that.
Same effect.
Right, right. And Mr. Chair, the Senate on Section 30 is recommending the Senate language in its offer. And that one specifies legal driving behavior when a motor vehicle operator has to cross a bicycle lane to make a turn. And the Senate language states that the driver shall first signal the movement, drive into the bicycle lane, and only after it is safe to do so, and then make the turn consistent with traffic markers, buttons, or signs. So,
with the yield to the bicycle as well.
And it adds, right, bicycles to motor, to vehicles that have to be yielded to.
All right. So the Senate offer is to take the Senate language. Questions, discussion, motion.
How far do we go here with the?
We covered on the Senate side, starting on R19, sections 28, 29, and 30. All right.
On the House side, it's
Identical, except that section 28 has slightly different language in paragraph G.
Okay,
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, we're working on an amendment here on some equipment that it's comfort language for the bicycle sellers, and I'm not sure if we're going to find it in this particular.
There's some other bicycle provisions that are House language only. Is that where we would pick up that amendment?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, there was another provision that was part of the bicycle equipment, and it just very recently came to light that apparently it dropped out of the House position at some point. Haven't had a chance to look at what occurred in the process.
Okay.
It was discussed, I think, at some points in the committee. It's in a separate section of law, so we're working up an amendment that could be offered at a slightly later time, once we get the language in front of
you. All right. So do we have a motion on taking these provisions? City of Minneapolis representatives are here. You're just here to testify or just answer questions?
Mr. Chair and members, I'm just here to answer questions.
All right. Thank you. All right. All in favor? Oh, actually, I need a motion.
So move.
All right. Senator Carlson's motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you. All right. So moving on, we have some more bicycle provisions on the House side, starting with Section 29. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and committee members, Section 29 on the House side makes a couple of changes that could be viewed as a bit of a modernization about bicycle equipment and types of bicycles being referenced on passengers on a bike. So it would revise safety seats and child passenger. And then there are a couple other provisions that go along with that later, but actually Section 30 is from a separate, also bicycle related, but it came out of a separate bill. That's also House only language and would modify the restrictions on bicyclists needing to operate on the shoulder or in the bike lane. When they are operating in those situations, they wouldn't have to ride farther most to the right.
Okay.
And then Section 31 is another bicycle equipment modification that would broaden capability to for bicyclists to be equipped with lamps to be able to have a lamp that is visible from both the front and the rear. So that's one piece of the equipment changes, along with some changes to braking and specifically allowing horns or bells to be part of the bicycle equipment.
Great. Senator Carlson, is this where you're wanting to make it? So members, Senate offer is to accept this House language
Senator Carlson, you're wanting to make a change?
Yes.
In this part?
And Mr. Burris is trying to work out the details of it.
Right.
There's a section, subdivision 7, that is not noted here, and this would be a modification of subdivision 7. So it would go, to our way of thinking here, it would go between 22.34 and 22.35.
Okay. Ms. Burris, do you need more time? Should we move on?
If we could move on, Mr.
All right.
Chair.
Very good.
Circle back to that one.
Great. We'll come back to those sections. Ms. Berzowski, starting with the more bike provisions.
Mr. Chair, the next provision is on R23, and on the Senate side, it is Section 31, and that section is specifies statewide parking prohibitions, and this section would prohibit parking in a designated bicycle lane except when permitted by posted signs.
Language is identical. Senate offer is to accept the language. Oh, there's a technical difference.
We're recommending the Senate.
So there's a technical difference. Senate offer is to I thought we were going to have to read. So the Senate offer is to accept the House language, not use the word designated, on line 23.25 on the House side. Is there a motion? There's a technical difference. The word designated got dropped on the House side. So we'd like to take the House language. All right, questions? Motions? Senator Carlson moves adoption of the House language. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed no.
No.
Motion carries. All right.
Mr. Chair, the next two sections on the Senate side are sections 32 and 33, and these relate to disability parking. Section 32 allows a vehicle with a disability placard or plate to park at an angle and occupy two spaces if all of the designated disability spaces are occupied or unavailable. And Section 33 strikes language in the disability parking law that provides that disability parking space signs may be movable by authorized persons. So the language that remains would require that signs be non-movable.
And I'll move both of those.
All right. Any questions, members? Testimony? All right. All in favor of the Mason motion, say aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. All right.
Mr. Chair, the next three sections, I believe, are identical on R25. Actually, I guess the heading is on R24, but the text is on R25. And Section 34 clarifies the rules concerning school bus drivers that they may not operate cellular phones while the school bus is part of traffic. So that is an addition, the part of traffic language. Section 35 specifies that seatbelts that are being used by drivers of school buses and Head Start vehicles have to be properly adjusted and fastened, and they have to use both the shoulder and lap belts when the bus is so equipped. And Section 36, it incorporates Type 3 vehicles, which you may recall earlier the committee adopted a new slightly streamlined definition of Type 3 vehicles in the section that has to do with the carrying of fire extinguishers, first aid kits, and safety equipment.
And the Senate would offer to accept the language. It's identical. Motion?
I so move.
On the Sawatsky motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
Opposed no. Motion carries. Thank you.
All
right. Mr. Burris, more horns on bikes. What are we just sticking horns all over bikes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a conforming change or another piece of the horns on bikes provision.
Right.
This is going into a section of law that specifically prohibits horns on vehicles unless they're allowed here. So it places the allowance for horns.
So glad our laws are extremely thorough and specific. It gives me great comfort. I sleep well at night. All right, Senate offers to accept the House language. I have a motion. Senator Carlson moves that. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, on R26, Section 37 on the Senate side, Section 39 on the House, and this increases the additional weight allowance for idle reduction technology from 400 to 550 pounds in determining the gross vehicle weight of a vehicle.
Great. And that is identical. Senate offers to accept. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
Chair Earhart moves. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Section 38 on R26 modifies the definition of valid medical examiner certificate in the driver's license chapter, and it states that a valid medical examiner certificate must be issued by a certified medical examiner under the Federal Motor Carrier Administration and listed on a national registry.
This is from the DPS housekeeping bill, Senator Kent. It's identical. Senate offers to accept the language. Do I have a motion?
I so move.
Senator Kent's motion. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you. And then I think this next section was not picked up. It was part of the DPS housekeeping bill, and there was, or was not picked up by the House, but there's been some, we've determined that something since, so. Mr. Chair, were you looking into this?
Mr. Chair and members, this provision applies partially to the Department of Public Safety and the Public Safety Committee. So we heard this provision. We passed it to Public Safety where it was also heard. And I believe, Chair Earhart, you're okay with accepting this?
Yeah, I am. And we have, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. McCormick at the table. Ms. McCormick, do you want to help shed some light on this subject?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Pat McCormick, Driver and Vehicle Services with the Department of Public Safety. As Matt stated, this part of our policy bill was heard in Representative Paymar's committee, and the committee did approve it, but it didn't make it back into the policy bill. Right. So it was approved on the House side in that committee.
Great. All right. So the Senate offers to pick up the Senate language. Do I have a motion?
So move.
All right. On Senator Kent's motion, any questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. Thank you. All right. Moving on.
Mr. Chair, the next two sections come from also from DPS, and they have to do with Minnesota identification cards for seniors. Section 40 states that the statutory description and the fee for those cards do not apply to the enhanced ID cards for applicants who are 65 and older. And Section 41 has to do with renewal of the ID cards. A regular ID card for an applicant age 65 or older does not need to be renewed, but for enhanced identification cards, they do need to renew them,
right.
I believe, every year.
And language is identical. Senate offers to accept the language. Any questions on Representative Sawatsky's motion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
Mr. Chair,
now that's another fun subject. All right.
The next section is Section 42 on the Senate side, and the language is not the same in the House and Senate. There are policy differences, but they affect the same section of law. The Senate side, it provides that on I-35E in the city of St. Paul, the department may not keep on the record of a driver any conviction for a speed violation within 10 miles over the limit. And on the House side, the extension, Mr. Burris, maybe you want to speak to the House.
Mr.
Gimler.
Mr. Chair and members, the House language is unrelated to the 35E provision. It extends the speed limit increase for when a speeding violation does not go on a record in a 60-mile-per-hour zone. That was increased temporarily to be 10 miles an hour over the limit instead of 5 miles an hour over the limit. And so the extension would be for an additional year that 10 miles an hour over the limit wouldn't go on a driver's record.
Thank you. The Senate does not offer either provision. Questions?
Yeah.
Motions?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Chairman, I believe the Department of Public Safety, they're reviewing this currently, and they're going to report back to the legislature. And this would sunset before that report came back. So we're asking for an additional one-year extension. And, Mr. Chairman, we lost out on the 60-mile-an-hour one, so I'm wondering, I would like to move this one and ask for your support, kindly ask for your support. For Section 41 of the House language.
I appreciate your plea and your appeal.
43, excuse me. 43.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair, these seem like they're pretty different, so how do they end up in the same comparison line? Why aren't they on separate sections?
Yeah, Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair, it's just the way the reviser does it for comparison purposes by putting the same section of law where, you know, opposite one another. So,
members, what you can do maybe is draw a line underneath on the Senate side to 26.25 and, you know, just draw it all the way across the piece of paper. And then on the House side, the extension of the Dimler expansion then is the language that's picked up on the House side. That language is not picked up on the Senate side, but then the language that is picked up is the what we call the Son of Dimler, the Senate amendment to allow for a Dimler type of policy for speeding on 35E adjacent to downtown St. Paul. So they're two separate matters.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hamilton.
Just for clarification, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarification, my motion is only to move Section 43 of the House language and not to move the other I-35 language. And again, my reasoning would be let's wait, give us some additional time, wait for the Department of Public Safety to review that and bring back the report, if you would, please.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Do we have any questions, any testimony on this subject? Ms. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, Scott Peterson from the...
Oh, we need to pause and go up and vote.
Got you all excited there, Mr. Peterson.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. We'll get back to this discussion.
Still great.
Extension of Dimler expansion. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is Scott Peterson from MnDOT. And the department does have some concerns about the provision in this bill that would extend the Dimler provisions in the House language. And basically, we negotiated the existing language with the House author last year for inclusion in the transportation policy bill. And the intent of it was to kind of resolve a difference of opinion that existed. Representative Erdahl thinks that this would have very little impact on average speeds and crash rates. And our concern with this provision is that it would encourage higher speeds, which, as all the evidence shows, does result in more and more severe crashes. And so we would prefer to leave the language as it is, allow it to sunset. We would take the data that we have acquired during the two-year period it's in effect and report back to the legislature, and at that time the legislature could make a determination based upon some real evidence about whether this is a good policy choice or not. Again, our concern always is trying to improve safety, and things like this kind of subtly move us the other direction. As Ms. Groth pointed out, you know, our goal is zero deaths, and we have a long ways to go, and so we're just vigilant to anything that moves us in the wrong direction.
Right, thank you. Questions for Mr. Peterson, members? All right. We have the Hamilton motion. Any questions?
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed no. No.
No.
No. I'm sorry.
All right. I need a division here.
It's a rolling no.
All right. I'll need a division. All in favor of the Hamilton motion, raise your hand. All right. With only two on each side, motion fails.
Oh, yeah, because it doesn't make sense.
There needs to be a majority on each side. All right. Motion fails. We have the 35E, kind of Dimler-esque provision, not in the Senate offer. Do we have any motion to include that?
Chair, I'd move to summarize some of the debate on the floor. Certainly not to change the speed limit, but only just to people in a position, if they happen to be stopped, to be a chance for the officer to point that out, remind them, send them on their way without that affecting their driving record. It does seem to be unusually slow for an interstate highway as you're coming into the city. It's obviously frequented by many visitors to the city, and it's I think it was presented that it'd be a good neighbor policy to implement that section of.
Thank you, and it is a Senate position, of which I am not supportive. I think just to recite the argument against, this is a product of a consent decree, an agreement between the City of St. Paul and a number of other parties, not the least of which are Federal Highways Administration, Department of Transportation, and even this would serve to defeat that consent decree and for sure trigger a lawsuit. A and B could trigger the need for the state to repay the significant sum of money, $40 million, Mr. Peterson, to the Federal Highway Administration, because it would reverse the conditions under which the agreement to all the parties agreed to, and would change the terms and conditions under which that grant was made by the Highway Administration. So with that, we have the Peterson motion. Senator Peterson.
Yep. So, Mr. Chair, and were you referring to Mr. Peterson from the DOT in regard
to
that agreement?
Yes. Who was nodding vigorously.
Okay. So if I could ask you a question relating to that, yeah. I would argue that none of those provisions in that lawsuit are changing. All we're doing with this amendment is just pulling those folks over and informing them that they were speeding, and that's just not going on their record. That's inaccurate. So how does that violate the? Because we're not changing the signs, we're not changing the speed limit. We're just not.
Senator Peterson, the argument goes that it would have a material effect in the speed that is driven, and Dimler shows. I mean, the experience of Dimler is that people do drive faster, and so it would defeat the goal and the purpose of the consent decree, and would open that whole subject back up. All right. Did you want to ask Mr. Peterson any questions or any? Did anyone want to testify?
So you're saying that if somebody is going to speed intentionally and risk getting pulled over and spending 5 to 10 minutes with an officer through that whole process, even though they just because they might know that there wouldn't be a ticket issued in that area. Is that what the, I'm not sure about the Dimler. Is that the lawsuit that you're referring to?
The lawsuit, Senator Peterson, was years ago when the freeway was built. City of St. Paul and the folks living in the area were resistant to the freeway, and there's a whole kind of municipal consent process, and so in exchange for granting municipal consent to the construction of the freeway, they were able to gain a number of concessions. One of which, a number aesthetics and other things. One of which was the speed, which has to do with volume, traffic. Traffic volume and noise and other things. So the argument goes that if this provision were to be included, that speed provision would be defeated. I mean, I grant you that the speed limit would remain the same, but the material effect is that speeds would increase along that stretch. Even though people were taking a risk of getting a ticket, our experience with Daimler around the state is that people do drive faster than they would otherwise, because they're than the posted limits, and then they would otherwise without the protection of Daimler. And so defeat the conditions and the terms of the consent decree. I can guarantee that a challenge would be filed and the whole consent decree would be reopened, because that's been promised already by spokespersons on behalf of the neighborhood. So we know that we would end up in court and this question would be tested.
Thank you.
All right. Anything further?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's I would only argue, and I'd encourage members to support it. I don't think people are going to intentionally speed, because if they do get stopped, it's going to take them much longer than driving. It's just a matter of if somebody's coming in visiting from out of town primarily. It's an unusually slow stretch for an interstate highway, and it gives them a redo. We've all are familiar with that term. It gives them a little redo and a chance for the officer to educate them on that stretch of freeway. It doesn't change the speed limit. It just doesn't give them a ticket and doesn't put it on their driving record. So,
great. Thank you. All in favor of the Peterson motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
Motion fails. All right. Moving on, section 43 of the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, 44 on House. On page R29, the Senate is proposing adoption of section 44 on the House side, and this establishes the position of transportation ombudsperson. And the difference between the Senate and the House is that the Senate requires that amounts that are paid to pay the costs of the ombudsperson position have to be specifically appropriated. The Senate is recommending adoption of the House language that does not have the appropriation requirement.
All right. I believe paragraph D was a Peterson amendment in committee. If he wants to defend his language or not, but the Senate offers to accept the House language. Questions, members? All right. Do I have a motion?
No move.
Senator or Representative Earhart makes the motion. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
Mr. Burris.
And Mr. Chair and members, section 45 on page R30 is a House-only provision. It would extend the due date on a freight rail economic development study that is in progress. So it would push that due date out from September of this year to November 15th of this year.
All right. Questions, members? Senate offers to accept that provision.
I'll move that, Mr. Chair.
All right. Hornstein motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
And then, Mr. Chair and members, the next provision also on page R30 would require MnDOT to use a manufactured in Minnesota manufacturer of solar panels when constructing MnDOT facilities that have solar panels.
That is not in the Senate offer. Questions, members? Motion. All right. Moving on.
Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, the Senator Made in Minnesota designation, is that the Made in Minnesota designation that appears in another bill?
Senator Carlson, no. I mean, it's similar, but no, it's different. This specifically has to do with MnDOT facilities and putting solar voltaic on MnDOT facilities.
The Made in Minnesota is not the same description that I believe is in another bill that requires UL approval and some of the other restrictions, and it limits it to two suppliers in Minnesota.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I'm not familiar enough with the other provisions to say whether the definition is exactly the same. My general understanding is that similar language is moving in other provisions. As Chair Dibble said, this provision with that definition is specific to MnDOT and facilities constructed by MnDOT where they're using solar panels.
All right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
So I guess I wanted to just clarify with Mr. Burris. So I know we, I think this was in our energy policy omnibus that we voted on yesterday, some variation of it, but do you know whether the Made in Minnesota solar for MnDOT is moving anywhere else, or is this the only place it's in the House?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I'm not sure about whether the MnDOT-specific version has moved anywhere else.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, I know it may not be the most popular thing in the world, but I do feel that it was in our House position, and I would like to move it, but, you know, the committee can do what it
needs. All right. All right. Questions, members, on the Hornstein motion? Anyone want to testify? All right. All in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
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 Motion fails.
Mr. Chair, on page R31, section 44, on the Senate side, gives, this is also related to a repealer at the end of the bill. It gives discretion to MnDOT to schedule payments of Greater Minnesota Transit Provider Operating Assistance. There is a schedule that is repealed in the bill, and this is more discretionary approach. It's similar language on both sides, but the Senate is offering the Senate language.
All right. I'm sorry, I was listening with only half an ear. Is there a effect of both is the same? All right. So the Senate offer is to offer the Senate language. Questions, members? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Section, then on the House side at the bottom of R31, carrying over into R32, the Senate would recommend the House language on what is a similar provision with just a technical difference, authorizing MnDOT to establish an office to deal with public-private partnerships involving public infrastructure investments and work with other state agencies in this effort.
All right. So Senate offers the House language. Is there a motion?
Okay. What is the number that you're working on over here?
R31.
Section 44 and Section 42.
We are...
Okay, I found it. Thank you.
Okay. All right. So establishing a program office, a joint program office for public-private partnerships. All right. Is there a motion?
I will move.
On the Mason motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Carries. All right. Ms. Burris.
And Mr. Chair and members, the next two sections are House-only provisions that are related to each other and concern passenger rail. Section 49 on page R32 establishes a cross-reference to the United States Code for defining passenger rail and also adds Amtrak as a possible entity that the Commissioner of Transportation could enter into an agreement with for rail operation. And then Section 50, also starting on page R32, again adds Amtrak and specifies some of the authority that the Commissioner of Transportation would have regarding entering into agreements with railroads and types of federal law that would kick in and areas that could be covered, such as indemnification and joint use of right-of-way and liability, that would be aspects of what the commissioner could address in an agreement for operation of passenger rail. And finally, the provision requires the commissioner to hold federally required public hearings.
Very good. This is an issue that's been around for a number of years. Questions? Senate offer is to accept the House language. Are there questions? Anyone want to testify on this subject? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move.
Oh, Senator Representative Hornstein beat Representative Mason to the punch.
But I would defer to Representative.
All right. We'll make it the Hornstein motion. He's been working on this for a long time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, beginning then on page R33, section 46 on the Senate side, there's a series of identical provisions that came from MnDOT's department bill. Section 46 adds a yield sign as a permissible type of warning sign at railroad grade crossings. Section 47 requires railroad companies to place grade crossing warning signs within 50 feet of the nearest rail, and that's a change from 75 feet, or at a greater distance as determined by the commissioner. Section 48 adds references then to yield signs at railroad grade crossings that are not equipped with flashing lights as an alternative to stop signs. Section 49 is related to a previous provision, and this requires that medical examinations for intrastate commercial motor vehicle drivers be provided by certified medical examiners listed on the National Registry. And Section 50 amends the section that allows the commissioner to grant waivers to intrastate commercial vehicle drivers. It strikes language that requires the commissioner to deny an application for a waiver for an applicant whose license was suspended, revoked, or canceled during the previous 3 years.
Okay. Why don't we pause there? So this is all identical. And
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Senator Kent.
It says on the summary here that in Section 49 that there was a technical difference.
Oh, okay.
If counsel could please clarify.
Oh, promulgated versus adopted.
Oh.
So, which word do we like better, promulgated or adopted?
Well, my personal opinion is it doesn't make a bit of difference.
So who wants to make the motion? You get to pick. Promulgated or adopted? Adopted is House language. Promulgated is Senate language.
I so moved, and I'll say adopted.
All right. Representative Slotsky moves the House language for those sections.
Sorry.
Sections, which we'll just 51, 52, 53, 54. Is that it? Oh, and there are 50 and 55. All in favor, say aye. And questions,
aye.
Testimony? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, but some of that wasn't accepted.
No, that was like for the SAT or something.
Not sure what we just voted on.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay. So we'll review. And if we need to consider, we will. We just adopted on the House side, really with only, there's only one difference.
Okay. No.
Sections 51, 52, 53, 54, 55. And that's it. All right.
I'm good with that.
All right. Very good. All right. So then we had left off at Section 51 on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, Section
R36. Okay.
Yes, R36, Section 51 on the Senate side, and these are identical, I believe, and this modifies the statutory exemption for agriculture commodities and farm supplies from federal hours of service regulations, and this is... this is a little bit of MAP 21 conformity. So it clarifies, it enlarges the exempt area from the federal hours of service regulations from 100 to 150 air mile radius from the source of the commodities or the distribution point, and then it adds that the distribution point may be retail or wholesale, and this is immediately effective.
All right. Senate offers to accept the language. Any questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, on R37, Section 52 is Senate-only language. and that authorizes the seven metropolitan county regional rail authorities to pay the costs of developing bus rapid transit in transit ways that are in the Met Council's policy plan.
All right, Senate offers to accept this language. Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I'd recommend we do that. I just wanted the committee to know that we have language similar to this in the finance bill on the House side. It only relates to Washington County, but makes a lot of sense to do this metro-wide.
Great. Thanks. Questions? Testimony? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries.
All right.
And then, Mr. Chair, on the House side, on page R37, there is ombudsperson provision. This would be for metro mobility and would establish an ombudsperson role similar powers and duties as the transportation ombudsperson that was discussed earlier.
Okay. The Senate is not offering this language. Any questions? Testimony? Motion? All right. Mr. Shetland.
Liz is on the floor.
Welcome,
thank you,
Mr.
Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetland. I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Met Council. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you regarding this issue. This was a floor amendment that Representative Holberg offered when the bill was up last week, and I have since spoken with her. I believe that this is redundant. The council, when we do have an issue with metro mobility, we have a very comprehensive customer relations process that we go through, but we also have a very stringent federal process that we have to provide, which is an appeals process for any type of denial, no-show of a ride or of an application. If given the opportunity to talk about this in the committee process, I would have also explained that we have a committee called the Transportation Accessibility Advisory Committee, which is made up of folks who speak on behalf of the disability community. There are 16 members of this group, which half of them have to be members who are ADA certified, and that is another forum for folks to be able to come and speak to issues related to our ADA service or our metro mobility service. So I would speak against adopting the House version of or language here, and if there are issues down the line, I'd be happy to revisit it, but we just feel that it's redundant at this time.
Thank you. Mr. Shetland, questions, members?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, thank you. First, I guess, a comment, and then maybe more of a request. On the way down here, I was speaking to a gentleman that is in the halls quite often at the Capitol here, who gave me some specific examples of where, in one case, there was a gentleman who was disabled that was left in an idling vehicle as the driver was filling it up with gas, and there's some other examples that he gave as well. And I believe that was one of the reasons why Representative Holberg brought this forward. I did talk with Representative Holberg as well. And as long as you're addressing this, I'll talk to you after this as well and give you the name of the individual that I spoke to, and we'll work offline, if you will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hamilton. I'm very aware of the situation and the gentleman. We've had numerous discussions with him, and we will resolve that. A lot of it, I believe, has been resolved, just in a way that might not be to his satisfaction. However, we have gone through all of the appeals process and followed all of the different processes that we have, and an ombudsperson position, I don't believe the situation would have been remedied any different. But again, we take issues with our ADA riders very seriously. On top of that, we also have strict federal regulations that we have to follow. And I just want to assure you that it is not a normal situation for us to have what Mr. Hughes has brought forward, and we're well aware of it, and we'll take care of it from here.
All right. Appreciate that. All right. That does not sound like motion. Sounds like we're moving on. All right. All right. Dan, another fun subject. Dan Patch.
Mr. Chair, on the Senate side, on the bottom, begins on the bottom of R37 and continues on to R38. And this amends the prohibition against against developing the Dan Patch line, and it amends it by taking out the prohibition against study or planning. It leaves in place prohibitions against engineering, final design, and construction. And it also takes out language that prohibits references other than historical references to the Dan Patch Line in future council plans and MnDOT plans.
So as I like to say, you can now think Dan Patch, but you can't say Dan Patch. So, Mr. Shetland, did you have any words of wisdom on this particular provision?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding this provision, the council does not have a position related to the Dan Patch corridor, but we have a position of supporting lifting the prohibition on the fact that having a unique prohibition in statute really goes against the principles of regional planning. But I want to make sure that, again, it's clear that it's not an endorsement of the line, but more just to lift this unique prohibition.
Right. Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Harson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Shetland. Is this corridor, as it was envisioned in the late 90s and early 2000s, has this appeared in any are there any similar corridors in the that are in the vicinity of the Dan Patch corridor that have been either planned for or implemented since then that would perhaps make this obsolete?
Mr. Shetland.
Well, Mr. Chair, Chair Hornstein, there have been investments in other corridors. I don't believe it would make this corridor obsolete because it is an actual corridor, even though I can't pretend that there is one based on the legislation. But the there have been investments with the Urban Partnership Agreement that you and Chair Dibble are both well aware of, with the Cedar Avenue corridor and the 35W corridor, and then also we're planning on investment in the Southwest corridor as well. So in regards to transitways, yes, there have been changes made since the prohibition went in place, but regarding the actual line, it is what it is.
Thank you.
All right. Senator Carlson?
I'm ready to move on when you are.
All right. Well, this is not in the Senate offer. However, I think a motion is in order.
I would like to make a motion. I mean, we did approve it in the Senate, and it was brought forward by someone. And I know you're talking about, you know, lines, but this one goes down to Northfield. I don't know. Has there been investment that goes that far south? And it doesn't eliminate the preliminary engineering or the design or construction. It's just saying, you know, we can talk about it or think about it and maybe study and study it. So I would like to move that we accept 31.31 to 32.18.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Earhart.
Oh, I was hoping I didn't have to get into this, but there was a study done, $99,000, $2,000, several thousand dollars, and maybe more were spent on money that was given to Dakota County. They hired Parsons Brinkhoff to do the study. Their conclusion was, after many, at least a number of open houses and explanations, that this corridor is in the report of 2001. The corridor was unacceptable at this time for what was being planned as a railroad corridor. There is
I think there's a division up on the floor that we probably need to weigh in on, so we're going to pass for a moment. Order.
Yeah.
We're getting through this thing. So. It's going to happen. All right, so we were hearing from Representative Earhart about a study that determined that the Dan Patch was a bad idea.
At this time,
all right,
here was their conclusion on it.
All right.
Feasibility report, final report, December 28, 2001. Essentially what they said was there are too many hazards along the way. The line has to, because they're homes, along four communities, St. Louis Park, Edina, Bloomington, and whatever is south of there. They were running through the backyards. People who had kids that are playing along the track, they'd have to spend too much money picking up right away. They have to build sidings, have to redo the bridge in crossing the river, and that they would suggest that there be no further action on that line until such time as the North Star was built and running successfully, and the Red Rock was built and was running successfully. And then possibly they might come back and take a look at it again. As we know, the Red Rock has not been built. We know that the North Star is not returning the right amounts of money on Fairbox that it needs to do. And furthermore, there is now expenditures going underway for other rail situations that are sucking up the money, and we've got two BRTs that run down to that general area now. So that's our objection, along with six or seven of the representatives that are from in the House that are from St. Louis Park, Edina, Bloomington, and Point South. So that's the reason that we're I'd like to keep that on there.
Sounds like the planning and analysis process worked as it should in that case, and so specific statutory prohibition maybe is unwarranted and mm-hmm. kind of unique in this circumstance. So that's my speech in favor of the Jensen motion. All right. Anything further, members? All in favor of the Jensen motion, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no.
No.
No. No.
Motion fails. Sure. Division. Division has been requested. All in favor, raise your hand. All right. Opposed, raise your hand. Motion fails. All right. Moving on. We have Section 54 on the Senate side.
Mr. Chair, Section 54 is Senate-only language, and that extends a sunset from 2013 to 2017 for accepting individuals into the driver's license diversion pilot program. And then it also extends the sunset from 14 to 18 for collecting and dispersing fees under the program.
All right. Senate offer is to accept, is to offer the Senate language. Any questions? Any testimony? We have a motion.
So moved.
All right. On Representative Hamilton's motion, questions? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
We have it now.
Mr. Chair, Section 55 on page R38, this is Senate-only language, and that requires the Metropolitan Council and City of St. Paul to provide access to a pedestrian skyway system by means of an elevator at the Central Station site during the initial construction of the Central Corridor light rail transit line.
Yeah, I know.
And Mr. Right. Chairman, if I could, I'd like to move this one as well, if I could, please.
All right. Representative Hamilton moves Senate language on Section 55. Mr. Shetman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. In regard to Section 55, in committee we've testified to this in the past as well, but we are constructing that elevator. And update since last time I testified before the committees is that we had a question of who would be maintaining the actual elevator, and we have an agreement, mostly an agreement with the City of St. Paul, that we will share the cost 50-50. So this is happening and will be done, and I think all parties are happy with it.
So, Mr. Shetman, do you object to the language, or is it okay if the language survives?
Mr. Chair and members, it's really the prerogative of the conference committee. I don't believe it's necessary. because as we said earlier this year that we were planning on doing it, we are doing it. We found the money through the contingency that became available. But it's up to you. I personally don't think it's necessary.
All right. Mr. Shetner, I think we'll trust but verify. Representative Harnstein.
Thank you, Mr. Fair. Chairman. I just wanted to let the Senate know that we also have this in the House, but in our finance bill. So there's a House, you know, position right. indirectly in support right. of this.
Great. Thank you. This is brought forward by Senator Carlson. Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, so you're going to pay for it?
Yes. We trust that the Met Council will pay half as they have committed to do. So.
All right. Great. On the Hamilton motion, any further questions or comments? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries.
All right. Next. Mr. Burris. Peace.
Mr. Chair and members, the next item is on page R39. This is House only. This would provide authority for MnDOT to convey land in Couchiching County that's part of a Pigeon Hill cleanup site, some contaminated land. And this is a kind of corresponds to a fiscal component that's moving, at least on the House side, in the House finance bill. So this would be authority for conveying the land, and it describes the track that's involved.
All right. Senate offers to accept the House language.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Rudine.
If I may, we appreciate your support. We would just ask if you could include an immediate effective date so that we wouldn't have to wait until August 1st to make this transfer.
We just include that motion by direction, immediate effective date.
Mr. Chair, yes, I think we can handle that.
All right, very good. So has anyone moved?
Sorry.
Speaks. Motion.
I'll move it.
All right, Representative Mason moves the House language with the direction to staff to also include an immediate effective date. All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
Mr. Chair, on R40, the next section on the Senate side is Section 56. And these are identical provisions on both sides. And this provision would authorize MnDOT to quitclaim the land that's described in this section to a private party in return for the cost of planning and constructing and equipping a rest area facility.
So this, members, is Cambria, correct? They want to expand their factory. Is that correct? And they're going to move part of that project, I think, would encroach upon an existing rest area. So there's going to be some sort of deal cut so that a new rest area close to that spot. All right. So, but it's identical, so we all know that. Senate offers to accept the language. Senator
so
Kent
move.
Makes the motion. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, the next section begins on R41 and continues on, the text is on R42, and that is Senate Section 57, Senate only language. And this is an effort to comply with MAP 21 by directing the Commissioner of Public Safety to refrain from enforcing state laws that conflict with the federal law as the rules are being promulgated or adopted. And the section is immediately effective.
All right. Senate offers to accept the Senate language. Any questions? Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move that. I'd make that motion. I believe this is a Representative Faust, I believe, brought this up, that this is important to the ag community as well as we work with the federal government for the conformity issues.
Right, right. And Senator Scoy, I think, had offered this, or Senator Jensen on behalf of Senator Scoy had offered this language. Same motives in mind. All right. All in favor of any questions, testimony? All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
Do you
want to
language or
yeah.
just describe
some of it? Yeah,
well,
go ahead and describe it.
Mr. Chair, the next section is Senate-only language, and on R42, it's Section 58. And this relates to the U.S. Highway 53 relocation project between Eveleth and Virginia. And this section directs the Commissioner of Transportation to implement specific layouts when relocating Highway 53.
Members, I am aware that there has been concern expressed by the Federal Highway Administration on this. Mr. Peterson, I know, probably wanted to articulate that concern. And then we also have an amendment to change the language. I don't know, if, Mr. Peterson, if you've seen this.
Mr. Chairman, I believe I have seen that language.
Okay. All right. And then we'd like your response to. So we'll pass out this A25 amendment. So is the Senate position, or Senate offer, is to accept this language. The amendment I just became aware of, so we'll deal with that in due time. All right. Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, we have gotten a letter from the Federal Highway Administration with their reaction to this proposed language, and basically their position is that this would not allow the process that we're currently involved in trying to find a new location for Highway 53 to comply with the requirements of NEPA, Environmental Protection Act, and therefore they would not be able to participate in the cost with federal funds, nor would we be able to get permits from federal agencies. So it creates some serious obstacles for us to be able to complete that project. And just right at the beginning of the conference committee hearing today, I was shown this language, and I have been working with Senator Thomas Lane and his staff on language that would provide that the citizens up there are some comfort that we're making all reasonable efforts to find a good route, alternative route for this relocation. And this language does appear to me to be of a form and nature that Federal Highway would find acceptable. I have not had a chance to confirm that with them, so I would add that caveat. But their concern is that this process, you can't predetermine what the outcome will be. You have to consider all reasonable alternatives, and so we need to continue to consider them until we've investigated them to the point where we've identified a preferred alternative based upon the environmental, social, and economic impacts of the alternatives. And so I think that this this language here allows us to pursue that process in good faith.
All right. All right, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I share MnDOT's concerns, and I hope this language will allay those. Also, again, so I'm a broken record here, we have similar language in the finance bill. So I guess, Mr. Chairman, we could move this, and if there's a problem, we could potentially correct that down the road in the next conference committee.
All right. So the proposal then would be to offer the A25 amendment in place of Section 58 on the Senate side. Does anyone want to make that motion? Senator Kent?
So move the A25.
All right. Any questions, members? Any further testimony? All in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right.
Mr. Chair, the next two sections are identical on both sides. That's R42, sections 59 and 60, and those relate to turnback provisions that were adopted earlier today.
All right. Language is identical. Senate offers to adopt the language. Do I have a motion?
So
Representative
move.
Mason so moves. Questions? Testimony? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, Section 61, which begins on the bottom of R42 and continues on to R43, is Senate-only language, and that is language that directs MnDOT, with funds from non-state sources, to erect a specific service sign on Trunk Highway 52. And that sign has to display the name or business panel of a store that was operated before a noise wall was constructed that blocked the view of the business premises from the highway.
So, members, this is a Senator Senjum effort of many years in duration. I think previously it was Senator Murphy that had made this attempt. And what this has to do with is a Red Wing shoe store. So shoe stores are, if you remember the Senator Kent's updates to the business services advisory signs that are acceptable to place on the blue signs on the freeway saying that a DQ is coming up or something like that. Shoe stores don't fall into that category. So they're seeking an exception in this case. I don't know if the House has heard this or are familiar with this whole subject, but the issue is noise wall went up. Big, cute, it's kind of a destination shoe store. It's kind of hidden behind the noise wall now. Okay. And so anyone who you might want to go to the shoe store or who has seen the shoe store and think, oh, cool, I'm going to go buy some really awesome Red Wing shoes, are past the point that they can turn off. And the business did show their drop in revenues is pretty substantial and pretty dramatic. And so the Senate committee saw fit to include this. So the Senate offer is to, at long last, allow for this exception and accommodate Senator Senjum's attempt to help this little business down in his neck of the woods. So, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The department does have concerns about this provision. Just briefly, these signs are there to provide guidance to travelers who are probably unfamiliar with the area where they can find services that they need that are needed by travelers. So that would be gas stations, lodging, and food primarily, in addition to attractions now that in the other provision in the bill. And so shoe stores don't fall into that in any of those categories. And by opening it up now to other types of retail businesses, even just shoe stores, there are several other shoe stores. We have a map of other shoe stores in Rochester in this vicinity that would then be eligible for sign placement, basically, by this precedent. And I would like to point out that these signs are not meant for advertising. They are services to travelers. And so the Red Wing Shoe Store has the opportunity, as other businesses do, to advertise, to purchase sign space to alert travelers or people looking for their business to the location of their business and do it as other retail businesses do. And I know there's a lot of conversation about this when this provision came up about, you know, people, yes, maybe people driving from Brainerd to Rochester to buy a pair of Red Wing shoes and they wouldn't know where to go. I don't think that you would find many people who are familiar with the retail industry to think that people would travel, you know, to a long distance to find a pair of shoes in a place that they're unfamiliar. I mean, it's just typically not how, not typical shopper behavior, I would say. So we would request that that the conference committee not adopt this provision.
Great, thank you. Representative Mason.
Two comments. One is Red Wing is a pretty special shoe store. Even I know Red Wing, and that has been a place of destination. But more than that, I guess my thought is, don't we have some obligation when you're putting up those big walls to do something to mitigate or do something to help the stores? I mean, putting up those walls is significant. And I don't know. That is my thought. I mean, when you put up these walls to block off a shopping area, that's pretty substantial.
Senator Peterson, did you?
Mr. Chairman,
that's obligation to
Representative Mason. You know, when we do these construction projects, we do provide a lot of temporary signing and other assistance to businesses that are impacted by the construction. I would point out that there are several other retail businesses in very close proximity to the Red Wing Shoe location, and the Red Wing Shoe store is the only one that's asking for this relief.
Mr. Chairman,
Representative.
This is not the factory store. I mean, you don't go, the factory's not there, and you're going to buy a pair of shoes from the factory. Is this just a regular shoe store?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hart, that's correct, yeah.
You know, just to respond briefly, I mean, I'm actually compelled by Senator Senjum's argument because of the unique circumstance in this particular case with the wall that blocks. You know, I don't think it's folks coming from Bemidji to Rochester to buy Red Wing shoes necessarily, but it is, you know, somewhat of a destination type shoe store. It's, you know, a larger shoe store that specializes in Red Wing shoes, and folks who are coming from Bemidji to Rochester obviously would know that this shoe store is there and are specifically going, but it's for the the folks who want to like pull off and as an opportunity who have some time on their hands and they see this store, and the problem is that poof, they're past and it's too late. Yeah. They see it kind of as they're going by, and they hadn't had the opportunity to move over and take the exit lane to get to that particular facility because the wall blocks their view. It's not like other retail or even other shoe stores in the area, Famous Footwear. I mean, that's way off the path there, and folks have plenty of time to see it and find it. Senator Jensen.
He was sure. My recollection of the testimony that we had in the Senate, this is fine representation other than we saw the wall and how it was when you drove and how long that particular business has been in that particular location and had, you know, put into that particular location, and all of a sudden there's a wall there. And you can't tell that from this. I mean, it blocks it completely. So that's the testimony that I remember, and that's the testimony that I voted on in favor of it.
And I also recall the before and after receipts.
Yes.
Fairly dramatic drop-off in their business.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Peterson. You know, I've been looking for a Flapdoodles ice cream store, and I see that's about the store. It seems to me that I would suggest to them that they ought to put up a sign there to make them happy. Now, Pappy John's Pizza, I can find that by my nose, but the ice cream store, I don't think so. I mean, you're really setting a precedent here, aren't you, if you do this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, that's our concern, and the reason for the map displaying all these other retail businesses is that we're now opening up the use of these specific service signs to potentially other retail operations who can say they're similarly impacted by the noise walls or the blocked view of their location from the highway. Just to reiterate, the signs were developed for a specific purpose to serve travelers who are looking for services associated with basically regional travel and people who are unfamiliar with the area.
Mr. Peterson, they do pay for the privilege of putting their sign on the blue sign.
Mr. Chairman, yes, that's correct. Yeah. There is a fee.
Because they do the food.
Representative Hornson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. As long as it's clear that we're not setting a precedent here, because I could see that then we would have a lot of businesses wanting to do this.
Creating an exception, not establishing a precedent.
And I also think now that we have a destination medical center, why not a destination shoe store?
Touché. That's the best joke of the conference committee. We need to write that down. That in the minutes. Best joke. All right. So, Senator Jensen, you're going to make the motion?
Yes, I am.
All right. Any further discussion? Any further testimony? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes.
House.
All right. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, on page R43, there is a provision that would require MnDOT to establish some additional signage at an intersection in Anoka. This is a two-lane road for most of this segment, but there are right turn lanes, and the signage would be required to specify the right turn only as opposed to the through lanes, and the cost would be required to be paid by the city of Anoka.
All right. Senate offer is to accept the House language. Any questions, members? Testimony? Is there a motion?
So moved.
Mr. Peterson.
I'm not moving it. Every time I move it, he gets up. It always fails. So let somebody else move this one.
We might make it up to you, Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to point out that there are, you know, standards for placements of signs that have to do with uniform attempts to control traffic in these areas. And I have talked to Representative Abler about this, and we are doing an engineering study now to determine if it's possible to place another sign in this location. His concern is that there's a right turn lane that extends past two intersections, and there's a sign that only says it's for right turns only where the right turn lane begins and not after the first intersection. Proliferation of signs creates issues for travelers as much as the lack of signs do in some instances. And so we would just urge the committee to, you know, let us try to work this out with Representative Abler and continue to uphold the standards for traffic control signing.
All right. Any questions of Mr. Peterson, members? All right. Nope. Any further testimony? Anything further on the Hamilton motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. Yes. There you go.
Oh, got one.
All right. Mr. Burks.
And Mr. Chair and members, Section 63, also on page R43, is house-only language that would modify the ignition interlock program. There was a pilot program, and then the program was made permanent, and there were some changes made in the permanent program, including allowing someone who's in the ignition interlock program to drive without using the interlock device when driving for an employer, so driving an employer-owned vehicle. The change in Section 63 would extend that same provision to the original people who are in the original pilot program.
All right. Well, I was going to say that we have this in our finance bill, but then the new version of the finance bill that appeared out of thin air this morning in tax committee, but apparently we don't. So the Senate position is to offer this language, this House language. Any questions, members? Senator Carlson?
I saw you've had someone coming up to testify. Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to know if the employer-owned vehicle requires a special classification license that this person still holds after being on the interlock requirement.
Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick with Driver and Vehicle Services. This program already exists in our ignition interlock program, and it allows, while the person is working, if the employer allows for them to use the vehicle and it's necessary for their work, it's reviewed by the department on a case-by-case basis. So it has to be that you really need that vehicle of the employer's to get your work done. During that period of time, you are able to drive the vehicle without having the impound plate on the vehicle. But then you would have to have the ignition interlock device on your own personal vehicle that you would use outside of work time.
Does that answer your question, Senator Carlson?
Mr. Chair, no. What I'm wondering is what classification of license does this person need to hold if they are driving for their employer?
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair, well, you wouldn't be able to have a commercial vehicle license, but you would be able to have the Class D license and be able to operate.
All right, thank you.
All right. So this is typically, if we can just conceptualize, just driving an employer car, for example, just in the course of your duties.
Mr. Chair, correct, or a light truck or something along those lines,
right.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. All right. Further questions, members? Or motion to accept the House language?
So moved.
All right. On the Representative Earhart's motion, questions? Any further testimony? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, on R43, there's a repealer, which is, there's a technical difference, but the substance is the same on both House and Senate. And the repealer language, or the sections and rules that are repealed, are all related to provisions that have been adopted into the conference report already. And the statutes that are repealed relate to issuance of one-way trip permits, and that's repealed. The Commissioner of Transportation transmitting operating assistance payments for Greater Minnesota Transit providers on a specific schedule, and that is being repealed here. And then the rules that are being repealed relate to the requirement of a notice of variance to be published by the Commissioner of Transportation for specific types of variances, and again, the MnDOT operating payment schedule for Greater Minnesota. And the Senate is recommending the Senate version of that language.
But they're basically all the same.
It's the same.
All
content.
The same. Right. Okay. Very good. All right. Motion to accept the Senate language. On Senator Kent's motion, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. Now we need to get back to some pieces that we skipped over.
We were going to accept their effective date.
Oh, right. And then there's a House proposal. Oh, is that in the... Oh, I'm sorry. That's right. It's on page R44 to establish the effective date, which is the default effective date, but just say it out loud. As August 1st, 2013, unless it's otherwise so stated. Senate offers the House language. Is there a motion? Senator Kent, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion carries. All right. All right. We're going to go back to Senator Carlson's equipment, bicycle equipment subject. What page?
I don't know.
Mr. Chair and members, this amendment is being passed out, and it impacts a new a subdivision that's not already in the side-by-side. That section of laws in other subdivisions are being changed elsewhere in the side-by-side. And what the proposed amendment change would be is to allow for sale of bicycles that don't have pedals, but otherwise meet the reflector requirements that are established by federal and federal regulations. Currently, my understanding is that bicycles need to be sold with reflectors on the pedals, and so if a bicycle is being sold to someone who is intending to use clipless pedals, they would still need to purchase a bike that has pedals with the reflectors, remove those pedals, and place clipless pedals on instead.
Very good. And where was this again? What page do we need to stick this into?
Mr. Chair, we can handle it at a staff level to insert this in the proper spot.
Okay, but I don't think we adopted that section. We just jumped over.
Section 31? R22?
We didn't do. It's R21.
Hmm?
R21, 22.
R21, 22.
All right.
We didn't do those whole sections.
Right. So section 29, 30, 31, we did not yet adopt. So, all right, is there a motion to adopt those sections?
So move.
All right. Any questions? Testimony? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carries. And then we have then an amendment to the conference committee report, which is what was passed out. Who would like to move this language?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Hamilton.
I'd like to move that, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to offer a different perspective. Individuals, say, with multiple sclerosis, you have spasticity, and normal pedals, because of the spasticity, your feet fall off the pedals. And so you get these special type of pedals with the clips in. And so, again, that's another reason that I'd ask for some support.
All right, very good.
So I'll move the amendment.
All right. Any questions? Any testimony? All in favor say aye.
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 Any opposition? Motion passes. All right. All right. Now we get to the scrap metal subject. Is that the only other thing?
I believe so. Did you have
to
do anything with that shop?
Right.
Well, I've got
it. Yeah, there you go. Now you know what it is.
All right.
Where are we doing? Bottom of the.
So, what we're reverting back to, members, is.
Okay, sorry. It starts on. Yeah. It's on 15.
So, we jumped over sections 23. There's several.
Let's see. Yeah, section
so 20, on
21, 22, 23, 24, 25.
So we had jumped over Senate only language section starting on the bottom of R14, section 21, 22, 23, 24. This all has to do with scrap metal vehicles. So what we have in front of us to consider is an 18-page bill. All right. Great. So who can help us with this? Who would like to? Representative Hornstein.
Well, Mr. Chair, I've been asked to move the A21. This is... at the request of Representative Mahoney, who I believe is the author of the bill. I know nothing about scrap vehicles. I'm not an attorney. So I think we probably need some sort of explanation, perhaps from Mr. Burris or somebody with some expertise. And then I'm offering this in the understanding that there is now some consensus among groups that have been in conflict over this for a long time. So if, in fact, that's true... Mm-hmm. And if you, Mr. Chair, feel it's appropriate to include this, I would leave it to the discretion of the chair and the committee. But I'm offering this at the request of Representative Mahoney.
Well, I know it's been in the committee. I don't know. Senator Weaver, I think.
Senator Weaver.
Well, I understand that Senator Weaker is Representative Mahoney's author in the Senate, and so if we're going to approve anything, we're going to have to get Senator Weaker down here and get his opinion on the subject. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm not speaking to the content of the amendment. The question that I have is, according to the joint rules, did this pass at least one body? And I know I'll be asked that when I go back to our caucus. So that would be my question.
Representative Hornstein.
And, Mr. Chairman, it certainly would not be my intention to offer something that has not been adequately heard or vetted according to the rules.
Mm-hmm. We looked into this a little bit, and according to the joint rules really speak to a substantially different subject. Can't bring an item into a conference committee report that deals with a substantially different subject. I think unless Senate counsel redirects me, I think, these sections that I cited that we jumped over are the similar subject. But to answer your question, Representative Hamilton, this is a bill that's moving through the process, that's been through a number of committees, but it has not made it onto either floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm.
All right. So there, I'm understanding that there may be items that are not germane to the bill, and we're going to have to identify those and not include them. This is a very ambitious project for a conference committee. I see 18 pages of new language here. So what is the committee's wish? We have the A21 in front of us. Should we hear from the proponents? See if we can get our arms around this whole subject.
Mr. Chair, I would also be interested to know if there are alternative pathways that exist in the legislature to move this. I think there are some legitimate issues around taking up a bill like this in a conference committee. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, I have to say, for my own part, the advocates have been pulling me in the hallway repeatedly, saying we have agreement, can we bring this into this bill? And said, well, you know, perhaps, but no one at any point said we have 18 pages of new language. It's the first time I've seen this. Yeah. This is a substantial subject to bring into a conference committee at the 11th hour. So I'm reluctant, but you know, I'm willing to follow the lead of the. I'm seeing other.
Feeling a little uncomfortable right. about it.
All right. I'm not seeing that we're going to get majority support, at least on the Senate side, for this proposal.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I would withdraw the motion in that
All right.
case.
All right. Thank you. So sorry for everyone who waited all this time, but I think that was pretty clear all day about this subject. Do we need to pick up these, look at these sections that are that we haven't dealt with? Ms. Berzovsky?
Mr. Chair, the sections in question begin on the bottom of R14, and sections... self-organized here. Sections 21 and 22 deal with motor vehicle dealers who buy first older model vehicles, and the second section is for late model or high-value vehicles for the purpose of dismantling or destroying the vehicle. And these sections require the dealer to, in all those cases, to obtain the certificate of title, to notify secured parties, and then to retain the certificate of title or a copy of the motor vehicle record in the dealer's records. And there are also notification requirements so that the dealer who buys one of these vehicles to dismantle or destroy has to notify the department within 10 days. And there are other requirements in terms of about record retention and so on.
Okay. I keep forgetting which sections.
21 and 22.
21 and 22. Okay.
Are those?
All right. All right. So my question to the advocates is, does this, if we were to adopt this language, does this do substantial damage to the work product in this new bill? Should we leave this language aside? In the Senate side, R14 to R15, sections 21 and 22. Oh, we're going to pause for just a moment. All right. So last item to consider for the committee is... sections 21, 22, 23, and 24. All right, we have the agency at the table. Welcome, Mr. Jordan, or Ms. McCormick, whomever wants to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jared Jordan, Government Relations with the Department of Public Safety. We have worked, in light of the fact that this committee chose not to address the amendment dealing with the scrap dealers. We did work with County Attorney Choi on that language, And we were okay with that language. In some degrees, it is probably even preferable in certain aspects to the language that is being addressed in your conference committee report. Having said that, since the conference committee withdrew consideration of the amendment, we do think it's important that some of those underlying provisions advance, and so we would like the language that is before the conference committee, at least as a placeholder, and that contains some stuff from the auto dealers as well. So our position would be we'd appreciate the conference committee moving forward with the language that is before it, and with all luck to the county attorney and the other advocates moving the scrap metal language, if that were to pass and become law, it would be from our analysis, that it would be a whichever law is second signed. Mm-hmm. Those provisions that differ from this would take precedent and become active law.
Correct.
That is what we would appreciate the conference committee considering at this time.
All right. Thank you.
My goal is not to do active damage to this, what was obviously hard work, and I feel bad that County Attorney Choi has been here all day. He's a busy man with a lot of responsibilities and has obviously been working hard, but I just don't feel like we have the capacity to. I had no idea we were going to be dealing with 18 pages of new language of a major initiative, without some guidance from Senator Wieger, who's the champion on the Senate side, so I apologize for that. So, but I thought I was pretty clear. If this proposal is going to bog down this conference committee, I was not interested in that. So the Senate would offer the Senate language on those provisions. Any discussion or questions? Senator Kent.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make the comment, having carried the agency bill that has this part of it in here and representing Ramsey County in part in South Maplewood and knowing that that has been an initiative, I've been trying to raise this question since I first got this agency bill and trying to see where are the commonalities. And so I am very sorry that we are not able to get both of these things accomplished at this point. So just wanted to add that.
And I'll note for the record, this whole subject just came up today. So, or was it yesterday? Yeah, yesterday. So kind of late breaking. I know things happen fast at the end of session, so I'm not being overly critical here, but we get some of us have a lot of stuff going on right now. So all right. So do we have a motion? Senator Kent moves the Senate side language. Any further questions? Any testimony? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed no. Motion carries. All right. So, is that everything? All right. Do we need a final motion?
Yeah.
All right. So, what is
it? Incorporate all of the adopted language into a conference
network. So, the final motion, Senator Kent, if you'll please make this motion, is to adopt all the provisions that the conference committee has dealt with into a conference committee report and direct staff to make any necessary technical and otherwise minor corrections to the report. And renumber the sections, all that. All right, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. I just want to, of course, thank our staff and thank the chairs. This bill I've carried in the past through the process, and it's never an easy one, especially on the floor. So really thank you to both of you. Appreciate your hard work.
All right. I echo thanks. I think it's a good committee and some good discussion and good debate. And I think we have a good product that we can carry back to the floor, our respective floors, and defend and pass. All right. All in favor of the Kent motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed no. Motion carries. And members, the reviser wanted to go home. We allowed them to do that, so the conference committee report will be available for signatures tomorrow.
Thank you.
Thank you.